I'm going to introduce both speakers, and then they will get up and speak in order. And then there'll be time, we trust, for some questions and conversation immediately following. Let me start by introducing you to Albert C. Black, Jr., who lives his professional and personal life with a commitment to faith, family, friends, and the free enterprise system. He serves as president of On Target Supplies and Logistics Limited, which is a corporate supply chain management company that he co-founded in 1982. His role as the organization's CEO has never restricted him from serving the public as a volunteer and as a community leader. Mr. Black is the youngest of seven children, raised in the Fraser Courts housing projects in South Dallas, attended Dallas public schools, then went to college on an athletic scholarship. He graduated from the University of Texas in Dallas and from the Cox School of Business at Southern Methodist University here on this campus with his MBA. An entrepreneur really from the earliest days of his life. He has developed successful companies in the inner city and has done that as a lifelong endeavor. As far as I know, his first entrepreneurial effort began when he was 10 years old. Now, as president of On Target Supplies and Logistics, his primary responsibilities are to assure the growth and profitability of the firm while guiding the transformation of the company's management team. This business has evolved from one that was firmly managed by a local entrepreneurial class of employees to a company that requires well-trained, experienced professionals in every management position. His civic experience includes service as chair of the Baylor Healthcare System Board of Trustees, as a regent of Baylor University, trustee of St. Louis University, and a member of the executive board of Cox School of Business here at SMU. He is also the treasurer for State Senator Royce West and recently elected mayor of Dallas, Tom Leppert. His dedication to business and community are important, but his priorities, as I've noted, are faith and family. He's a member of New Hope Baptist Church. He and his lifelong partner, Gwyneth, she is executive director of OTSL Charities, the charitable giving and volunteerism arm of On Target. His children, Oliver Victor Black, Albert C. Black III, known as Trey, and Cora Renee Black, are discerning advisors and his most precious assets. I know you will join me in welcoming Albert Black. Not yet. Our second speaker is the Reverend Dr. Frederick W. Schmidt. Fred is an Episcopal priest, is director of spiritual formation and Anglican studies, and associate professor of Christian spirituality here at Perkins School of Theology at SMU. As one of Perkins' senior administrators, he is responsible for programs in formation, serving over 500 students throughout the degree programs here at Perkins. He is an Episcopal priest, as already noted, and is canonically resident in the Diocese of Washington. Now, for those of you who are Episcopalians, that may make perfect sense. For those of you who are Baptists, it may seem very strange. But suffice it to say that an Episcopal priest can be canonically resident in one diocese while carrying out a ministry in another, in the same way the United Methodist ordained minister can be in an extension appointment outside the boundaries of an annual conference of which she or he is a member. Prior to coming to SMU, Dr. Schmidt served as canon educator, director of programs in spirituality and religious education, and acting program area manager at the Washington National Cathedral. He designed and produced workshops and seminars for ecumenical and interfaith constituencies. Before going to the cathedral in Washington, he was special assistant to the president and provost of LaSalle University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and served as a fellow of the American Council on Education. Before that, he was in Jerusalem. That's the one in the Middle East, where he was dean of St. George's College and residentiary canon of the Cathedral Church of St. George the Martyr. He's been a parish priest, serving parishes including St. Andrew's Episcopal Church in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and All Saints Episcopal in Hershey, Pennsylvania. His academic work is really in the area of New Testament studies, which he taught at Grantham, Pennsylvania, at Messiah College. His academic background includes training with an undergraduate degree at Asbury College, a Master Divinity degree from Asbury Theological Seminary. By the way, that's when he was a Methodist. And then he earned his Doctor of Philosophy degree from Oxford University, which is where the founder of Methodism earned his academic degrees. But alas, he always remained an Anglican, and Fred has become one. Fred's academic achievements include a variety of publications. He, in addition to his professional responsibilities here at SMU, also has served on the Institutional Review Board for Heart, Lung, and Blood Research at the National Institutes of Health, and he currently serves on two data safety monitoring boards for the NIH, and he's Secretary-Treasurer of the Anglican Association of Biblical Scholars. So again, I know you will join me in welcoming the Reverend Dr. Fred Schmidt. We'll begin with remarks by Mr. Black and then move immediately to remarks by Dr. Schmidt and then Todd Raspberry, who is Director of Development here at Perkins School of Theology, will guide us through a question and answer period to follow the two presentations. Mr. Black, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dean. And let me say to my dear friend, Karen Prothrow, the Honorable Karen Prothrow, thank you for the work that you're doing at the university. I hope that as the chairman of the board that you're not empowered to rescind my degree from the Cox School of Business. Well, good. I feel secure now, John. I always like asking that particular question. The PowerPoint presentation that we've got right here, I'm going to need a little bit of help. I'm going to start out talking about, I'm going to start out singing to you. I missed an opportunity to sing at the Kirk Franklin concert the other night. He had actually asked me to come up on the stage. I couldn't get up there, and so I'm going to take the opportunity today to sing a little bit. And what I'm going to sing is... Jesus loved me, this I know, because my grandmother told me so. I never knew and never learned the song like everybody else learned it. I wish I would have learned about Jesus through the Bible, but quite frankly, it was my grandmother in a little red pencil just marking that Bible. You may remember your grandparents. I don't even know where you can buy those little red pencils anymore. That little red wax pencil, that was before highlighting, that was before Kindles. And she would just sit there in the rocking chair and just mark the Word of God. That was good enough for me. And then she'd sing. She wanted her grandson to sing with me, and we'd just sing, Jesus loves me, this I know. And she would go on and sing, but I would just be happy to say, because my grandmother told me to. It was my father's mother, not my mother's. It was my father's mother. And we called her Mother Dear. And what an appropriate name. You know, she made me believe in angels. At a young age, I believed in angels. And I believe that she was a conscience for me. And I believe that she blessed me. I believe that God blessed her to bless me. She blessed me with the ability to understand that I was all right. It's something that I've tried to replicate with my children. I don't think I've been able to get it right. It is so hard for parents to let their children know that they are all right. What a blessing. We behave so better when we know that our cup is full. That's what it means to be blessed. It means that we just don't have to misbehave in this competitive world of business or politics or theology, that we can go about our business because we are blessed. Our cup is full. My grandmother's motto was, always look out for the other fellow. We've attempted to do that. We being my wife, Gwyneth, and I, as we've grown from our first engagement as youngsters that decided that we wanted to spend our life with each other. That was probably when Gwyneth was a few months older than me, and we both met. Her mother brought her over to our house in her little bassinet and little pink booties. And I just saw this gorgeous little baby over there with a wonderful bottle, and I didn't have a bottle, and neither did I have booties, and so I just crawled over there and got in her bed, and I've been in that bed ever since. Well, John knows the story is true, that I don't have a memory of when I met my wife. We've always known each other. The English professors out here wouldn't like me saying it, and surely my seventh grade English teacher would not like it when I say I've never not known my wife. Here's what Bill Cosby says about this great blessing, this angel in my life. He says, what is it about grandparents that is so lovely? I'd like to say that grandparents are God's gift to children. And if they can, but see, hear, and feel what these people have to give, they can mature at a fast rate. That's what happened to me. So this story about going into business at such a young age, you see, I was my grandson. I was my mother dear's grandson, and I was taking care of her business. Dallas, Texas, when we were growing up, was a different place. I was born in 1959, so when I'm forming a memory and getting ready to catch 14 Lego bus downtown, we're right around 1964 and 65. I don't have to go through the history you can get with Larry Adams and John Castle, and they'll go through the great civil rights histories for you. And for a small check of $5,000, you can join the Martin Luther King. But when we went down and shopped at stores, we knocked on the door before we went in. We could not go into stores in downtown Dallas and just walk in. There was no Civil Rights Act. And in Texas, we were still getting our act together. And therefore, my grandmother would say, Bubba, now don't y'all try that with that Bubba deal. She's still with me. She says, Bubba, you get those girls and you put them on the bus and y'all meet me in front of H.L. Green. And we're going to walk down the boats and we're going to get us some shoes. Because when you grow up, I don't want you standing on that bus line going to work. I don't want you going to work with cheap shoes on. So we're going to get you some good shoes. And so what my mother did, my grandmother did, is have me knock on the door. We'd look. If they didn't come, I'd get angry. And I'd walk up and say, I've got my grandmother and five sisters out there. Either you're going to let us in or we're going to be fighting. I was probably 7 years old at the time. That was risky. In Dallas, Texas, that was risky. I got away with it. I've gotten away with an awful lot. Dallas has been so good to me. See, it was her power of encouragement, of putting me out front, saying that I would be taking care of her business, putting me out front in front of my sisters, even at their expense. I learned to be a leader because my grandmother thought that I could take care of her business, that I could lead a tough clan of human beings called the Black Girls. They were rough, my sisters were. All these knots on my head. And I think the reason I don't have all my hair, one of them, is because my sisters pulled it out. They were tough, but I learned leadership. I learned that something could be done in this world and that I was going to be able to do it in business. I fell in love with this idea about my grandmother saying, this is my grandson and he'll be taking care of my business. I started acting like I thought business people act like. My father was a doorman at the Baker Hotel. And I would go down and just take a look at the businessmen coming in and out. And I tried to emulate what I saw as much as I could. My father would come home and talk to me about that. I wanted to be a businessman. I understood that we would have to get started. And over the years, we built Best Friends Lawn Service. It was a great little company. I started at the age of 10. We took it off to college. We ran it in four cities in the state of New Mexico. if you're ever out there in Santa Fe, right there on, in the Arts District where they have the little art stores right there in Santa Fe, there's the Santa Fe Commerce, Chamber of Commerce. Go in the hallway and you'll see there's a list of people that they think have contributed to that economy. Way back at 18 years old, we were able to go into the Santa Fe or the State of New Mexico Hall of Fame for putting together the Interfraternity Council to run lawn services across the state. I thought that was kind of cool. We came back and we started on Target with my wife, Gwyneth. We were both out of college at the time, and then Traco started in 1996. Ready to Work began in 2006. We started OTSL Charities in 2006, and our last project is AIM System, which is Advanced Inventory Management. We have a duty of care, and that duty of care is a sincere one. It's about the growth and development of people and the companies that those people work for and make. You see, free enterprise and my Christian faith has always created this kind of conflict. That thank God for friends like John Castle that has served as an available, steadfast, dear advisor for me throughout my formal career. When we really began to take business seriously, and during the ups and downs, John, you've never abandoned me, and so I really, really appreciate that. That's what friends are. Friends are people that are never too glorious with you when you're up, and they're never too disappointed when you're down. They're just available. Here's what Zig Ziglar said, and I thought it was pretty interesting. Albert believes that small business owners have to teach, preach, coach, and counsel, and truly believe that people are good, that people have potential, and people want to learn and grow like he has. You see, I've been committed to that my whole life. It's created a conflict. The conflict are, well, we're going to maximize profit or maximize people. And good economists, when customers have real incentives to pursue business that is marketing itself like we are, when our products and services are in favor, those kinds of values seem to be the right ones. When the economy is down, when you're taking management missteps, when you're stubborn and hard-headed, that kind of attitude can have you lose tons and tons and tons of money. That's the conflict that I've lived with. I've moved too slow when it came to reducing labor force, but I had the beautiful speak. During difficult and tough times, On Target will galvanize. Our employees will come together during this difficult economy, and what we will do is get through it. And as we do, we'll be stronger because of it. Well, a dear friend in my life and someone that you know very well said something to me one day in a meeting. It was Don Williams. He said, you know, Albert, what I know about bad economies is they're always worse than we think, and they always last longer than we thought. Don is so right. You see, because we're in a bad economy that has lasted 10 years, team. And so the values that we have for the Christian ministry at On Target Supplies and Logistics, we know it's real now. Because it has survived all of this tough time. And we've grown and developed with new business models just like we're supposed to. Just like they teach over at the Cox School. When it gets tough, get tough with it. Diversify. Do other things that the market will accept if your core product has not been accepted. That's what we've done. To manage faith in the work tension, we'll need to and see people the way Jesus sees them. As somebody that can get it done, somebody that just needs your help, somebody that needs the kind of time and attention that we can give them. We've made a business out of taking gleamy-eyed entrepreneurial followers and applying the disciplines of teaching them how to shake hands firmly, look people in the eye, and say their names with confidence. Tuck their shirt tails in and feel good about it. Shine their shoes and know what shoes to wear when you're going where. Things like lace-ups when you've got a suit, loafers only when you're sporty. We've done these type of things. My wife has spent so much time with young ladies and men, teaching them the proper way to use dinnerware. Now, whereas I still don't know which come first, which knife or fork come first, the employees of our company, they do. We feel very, very good about taking the personal interest in people's lives at On Target Supplies and Logistics. We did it at 10 people. We did it at 20. We did it at 30. We did it at 50. Now that we've got 175 people in the core business, with the ancillary business now over 100 people, it's getting more and more difficult. We're having to do it with more and more professional management. I miss the business. There's a clue to you what the future slides are going to say. It doesn't seem to be the same place. I like working with the people that I'm working with. There's a 360-degree circle of life, and I believe in it. You know, we have to employ people. Even in difficult economies, we're going to have to employ people. I'm asked to speak sometime around the United States. It seems like I do more of that that's healthy for our business sometime. I enjoy it. I always seem to learn more than the audience. What I say to people is, thank you so much when they introduce me. Yes, my name is Albert Black, and I am president of On Target Supplies and Logistics, and we're a team of 175 hardworking women and men on the south side of the Trinity River. We're a company that believes in offshoring. We think that offshoring is indeed on the south side of the Trinity River. We want you to continue to promote inner city companies like ours. If you will, we'll continue to expand the tax base. We'll continue to do things like promote independence of individuals. We'll do things like develop people that can make the kind of sustainable impact in communities that will make it better for us all. Now, if you don't, we're going to break in your house. Let's choose. What are we going to do? Are we going to create jobs or create penitentiary cells? We don't have a choice. Because the Bible tells me so. God promised us that if we didn't do his good, we would do the devil's evil. This I know. Because the Bible tells me so. As an adult, I've had to live without my angel. Very difficult. I have to rely on my Bible. Continue to reinforce the principles of good and the principle of evil. It's not hard to discern. We know that what we have to do is give people an opportunity. We have to employ people, improve infrastructure, add to the tax base, and develop leaders that are needed in the communities that we need to be a part of and not be afraid of. That's how we go about running the company. Now, don't misunderstand me. We're not a social colony. We're a company of MBAs and JDs. We're a company with one real idealistic, bright-eyed entrepreneur that doesn't seem to get things right. That's me. Everybody else needs to be shoveling coal. I'm the volunteer that spends a disproportionate amount of time doing things like this. There are ones back at the office making sure they get it done. We've done some great experiments. Energy experiments is the ones we like the most. Like the ones we were going to do at the superconducting super collider. It's when you take great people and put them on a ramp. People from south of Dallas housing projects, and people from places like Highland Park. and you just take them around and take them around those ramps. And then good scientists that are monitoring the experiments watches as we organize that collision. And what comes out of it is energy, that energy of entrepreneurship and professional management, growth and development with the Christian spirit. We're paying attention to our people. We're going and developing our community. We're going to do it today. And we're going to do it for the rest of my tenure at the company. For me, I'm preparing to be a loving and available Christian for my grandchildren as Jesus expects me to. You see, it's a 360-degree circle. My grandmother wasn't born an angel. She became one with her life experience. I wasn't born an angel. Everybody that knows me knows that. But I sure have been humbled over the years. You know, after thinking Sir Isaac Newton was wrong, for years and years I thought what went up, went up. And then 2002, the economy has smacked in 2001. We couldn't take it anymore in 2002. We began to peel back. My back began to hurt like I just didn't know what happened. I believe in a body-mind connection. Had 3 surgeries on my back in 3 years. I had a real big afro. It was just something you want to run your hair through if you saw me walking down the street. All my hair seemed to fall out. It was like a Job experience. If we walked in a room, I couldn't hardly walk in that room without me thinking that you were talking about me. If Karen and her friends were laughing, I thought, Karen, that you were laughing at me. You see, I didn't know that other people had the kind of experience that I had, that everybody didn't win all the time. I thought my friends expected me to. I couldn't handle it. It was so difficult letting my dear wife know that she had married Albert C. Black, Jr., and not Superman. I thought she would be disappointed with me. Not at all. She loves me just the same. We've made it out of that dark place. I'm not walking around with those ugly pictures that you may see on a magazine, touting the fact, some idea that I'm going to be running for a job or something. That's an ugly picture. You know what I mean? If I'm going to go out there and try to run for mayor, I'm going to take me a better picture. Yeah. I'm smiling now. I'm happy. I feel good about things. We're not where we want to be, but we're sure getting in the place that we can feel good about. You know, who haven't gone through a dark spot? We're together as a team. We're moving forward. I'm out here in beautiful weather with gorgeous students walking up and down the boulevard with good friends, good Christian people. And that's a blessing. Sooner or later, God will bless me with a grandchild, and I will be available for that grandchild, like my grandmother was available for me. Thanks so much.
This is essentially the low-tech version on the other side of the presentation. Albert, thank you. As Albert and I talked, one of the things that surfaced in the conversation for both of us was the way in which our family and life pilgrimages have shaped who we are and what we believe about the workplace and spirituality. And so that's the point of departure for my somewhat different experience as one whose father has been the huge influence in his life. Not always, I must say, honestly, of a positive nature, and whose grandparents were dead before I was a teenager. In September, I traveled to Phoenix, Arizona, to be with my father as he faced surgery to address a growing problem with massive internal bleeding. Now, after a fairly torturous process, he is recuperating in a rehabilitation center. And all being well, he will go back to his small home in Mesa, Arizona, at the end of the month. He is 85. For most of my life, my father worked as a sales engineer. He both designed and sold conveyor systems for a wide range of clients, including General Electric, White Motor Company, and Jack Daniel distilleries. He sold equipment for a variety of materials handling firms, and late in his life, he went into business for himself. When he did, my mother joined him and took most of the efforts that were associated with being an administrative assistant for him. I'm inclined to believe that it's only her death 10 years ago that finally forced him to retire. Toward the end of his work life, however, the inevitable changes in the industry itself began to take its toll. My father had a steady hand, a good eye, and even something of an artistic bent, artistic at least in the way that engineers are artistic. And by all counts, he was a skilled draftsman. He also possessed a certain public ease with people, a gift for gab, and he enjoyed the adventures associated with traveling. But as he grew older, his engineering skills faded as the task moved from the draft board to the computer, and the leading edge of the technological changes reduced his ability to produce the kind of product that people were looking for. I've had a considerable amount of time to reflect on his life, some of it spent in an intensive care unit, watching him draw on his interpersonal skills to navigate the vagaries of health care. He is no Moses, but like Moses, he's now standing on one side of the promised land. And Moses, like my father, faced a fairly daunting sales cycle in his 40 years in the wilderness. Among other things, I have found myself asking a long list of interrelated questions. How did his work shape his spirituality? How much did his spirituality shape his work? Now that he's retired, what is the relationship of the life that he lived to the one that he lives now? Was it prelude or an earlier chapter? Is his life in retirement shaped by the work that he did, or is it largely irrelevant? And what happens after the last sale? That, I confess, is a difficult contemplation. It's difficult in part because there is no objective answer to those questions. Difficult in part because my father lacks the vocabulary to answer them. And difficult because I lack objectivity about my father. But life is art. So there is some virtue in acknowledging the lack of objectivity and then asking the question, what can we learn? The substance of what I want to share with you today comes from that admittedly subjective, but I hope helpful place of years of working with men and women like Albert and like my father who are engaged in the business world. It's also shaped by my reflections on my life in the church and the academy, which, for better or worse, are not as different from the business world as many of you might imagine. As one who's worked for years in both worlds, I must admit that I've actually often wished they were less real. So allow me to make five observations that I hope will be helpful in reflecting on the task of living the spiritual life in the workplace. First, I would suggest it's important to live from a because, not an although. In the July and August edition of the Harvard Business Review, the editors of HBS featured an article by Professor Clay Christensen entitled, How Will You Measure Your Life? The article was something of a phenomenon. Hundreds of thousands went online to read it, and they picked up on its themes. David Brooks of the New York Times was among them. The editorial staff at HBR was so taken with the response that they chose to leave the article on the website through the month of October. And they noted that since its publication, Professor Christensen has faced bigger challenges than those posed by the world of commerce. He's been diagnosed as having lymphoma and a short time later suffered an ischemic stroke. What struck me about the way in which the editor introduced the online version of the article was the way in which he prefaced it. He observed, though Christensen's work and thinking comes from his deep religious faith, we believe that these are strategies that anyone can use. The though, or the although in that sentence, is something that I often hear when people talk about religious convictions. And it could mean, in the final analysis, a number of different things. It could mean, although you might not be religious, you might find something helpful here. It could mean, although I'm not religious, I found something helpful here. But it can also mean, although it's religious, it's still helpful. In all fairness to the editorial staff at HBR, I have no idea how many of those implied meanings might have been hiding behind the language. But there are times when I have no doubt that people mean, although it's religious, it's still helpful. The problem with that language is that although is not a because. When people like Christensen write out of a deep faith, they arrive there because of their convictions, not in spite of them. I don't know him, but I suspect that those are the convictions that have sustained him in these days of recovery. There is wisdom to be had from religious convictions that cannot be achieved any other way. Believing something about the existence of God and the nature of God, and with it the nature of human life, profoundly shapes the way we live. It isn't a disposable vehicle for achieving insights that can be had some other way. There are times when you are either religious or not, and you get it or you don't. So my first piece of advice then is, don't be pressured by a culture that believes in although into living without a because. You arrived where you are today thanks to your spiritual commitments and because of them, and you shouldn't be bullied by people who don't get it. Being committed to a particular understanding of God is not by definition intolerant. It is about a path and a vocabulary that gives traction to your spirituality. Second, don't confuse job with vocation. We live in a culture that's defined by doing, and there's much to be commended about our doing. It's created a culture and an economy that has not only benefited our nation, but many others as well. The downside is that we're done doing, we're very often done in every sense of the word. Our mindset, I think, was captured well by a columnist who wrote recently about the whole business of advancing retirement ages. She said, "Will Americans turn French or just work longer?" That's certainly one way of construing the choice, but ideally there ought to be an alternative to working longer, never mind becoming French. That is, I think, about distinguishing between our life's vocation and the work that we do. Vocation, from the Latin vocare, is about the call of God on our lives. It touches the way we are in the world, our sensibilities, our skills, our personality, values, strengths, and gifts. It's not about credentialing or employment. It is about becoming and being. The words healer, builder, evangel, teacher, and guide are better descriptors of vocation than are the titles neurosurgeon, subcontractor, salesperson, assistant professor, or consultant. But even those words fail to capture the individual and biographical nature of a vocation. Vocations are shaped over a lifetime and out of the tapestry of life. And jobs are an imperfect vehicle that express some of what we are, but not all of what we might become. Third, build a life and not just a business. The best of therapists and spiritual directors believe in the power of story. It's not the conceptual that typically changes our lives. It's the ability to tell our story and then to imagine what the next chapter might be. Storytelling of this kind captures the imagination in ways that concepts fail to do. And more importantly, they stimulate ownership and responsibility for the lives that we live. After having stood at the bedside of more than one dying friend, relative, and parishioner, I must admit to you that the most difficult and challenging aspect of it is to wonder how much the lives we have lived inform those final moments. So much of what we do in our lives is spent under various guises until those final moments. And I've concluded that the most terrifying dimension of it all must be not laying it down, but wondering how many moments of the lives we have lived have anything to do with that ending. A friend of mine who died some years ago now from an aggressive and unrelenting cancer was a state prosecutor. And he said, "I have one language for judges, another language for lawyers, a third language for the incarcerated, and a fourth that I use at home. I once convinced myself that I was speaking a different language to different groups of people, but I confess I no longer know who I am, and I no longer live my life from one page." It is important, I think, to know who we are. Fourth, don't check your values at the door, and don't stop checking your values. Some years ago, I assumed a leadership role in another country and worked with a foreign national. A man who had become a bishop after having served as a youth worker, who gained 100, 125 pounds and began speaking in the first person plural. I once told a friend of mine, "I've read Faust. I didn't expect to work for him." A month into my responsibilities, I discovered that a related support group for the organization was operating a pass-through account. And when I inquired how much money had passed through that account, I was told that the IRS had been informed that some $750,000 had been laundered using it. So I gave instructions to have the account closed and, in short order, lost the job that went with it. I have no doubt that the two were related. I have no doubt that it was the right decision. Unless our becauses, if I can put it that way, are a weak and calculated choice, it will require us to take our values into the workplace. And our work will require us to re-examine our values. Fifth, refuse to live from fear. Fear is the antithesis of faith. And if so, then courage is not bravado. It is the capacity to act faithfully, whatever the circumstances. During the economic turndown that Albert's talked about, I found myself in consultations with publishers, seminaries, and parishes about the way forward. And what I have been struck by is how many fear-based decisions are being made. Property sales and retrenchment have been the first things that many of them have considered and the choices that they have made, without regard for their footprint and without regard for the promise or presence that accompanies that footprint. They have sold property in cities like Boston, Chicago, and San Francisco where they are landlocked and have no hope of buying the property back, and they have disposed of property and of wealth that was bequeathed to them by previous generations at enormous expense. The problem here, friends, is not simply strategic. It also represents a spiritual dilemma. It represents a lack of courage and commitment, or what Edwin Friedman calls a failure of nerve in the age of the quick fix. Fear is not our friend. I have some students I take to a monastery in Oklahoma. And this year, when I took them there, they discovered that the monastery was actually making plans to build a retreat center. If you know anything about monastic life, you know that monasteries have lived in an age of hard choices for some time now. And the students wanted to know, why build a retreat center when you're not sure that there are going to be new monks joining you in the years to come? The response they tendered fell along these lines. We are called by God to do this work. And whether we are here to do it or not, this is the vocation that we have been called to. It seems to me that perhaps it's that radical conviction that shapes a life that makes sense from start to finish. A life that makes sense in the business life and makes as much sense in the halls of a rehab center. Life is filled with unanticipated challenges, each of them with their own significance in the moment that weighs heavily on us. But the lasting significance of both the first sale and the last sale is the way in which we respond to God's invitation. Moses must have felt that way when he looked into the promised land, whose borders he had approached but never crossed in 40 years. Keenly aware of the challenges that the children of Israel were yet to face, he reminds them not of the problems, but of the importance of Torah and the word that has been given to them. And he says to them, "It is not a trifling thing for you, this law. It is your very way of life." Thank you.
Doctor?
Now is the time when we get to engage our speakers in a few minutes of questions. And what I'd like to do is ask Albert and Fred, if you would, to come forward. And then if you'll raise your hand, we're recording these sessions. If you have a question for one or both of our presenters, if you'll raise your hand, let me bring you the microphone, then ask your question. That way we can get it recorded. So let's take a few minutes for questions and answers.
Well, Albert, first, let me apologize for wearing loafers with my suit today. I appreciate our friendship greatly, and there's an insight that I know you have that I was hoping that you would also share with us, because my son is privileged to know your son.
Yes.
And so we all, as parents, talk about how hard we had it when we were kids. In the case of your family, there's a special significance there. So help us talk about transferring that sense of responsibility, Christian responsibility, from a father to a son.
Well, we have, Dr. Smith said it, the something to the nature of the French, you know, will we keep working or will we become French? Well, then I'll keep that French in mind by saying there's a French saying that goes, noblesse oblige. What is the responsibility of the noble class? And that's what we've said to our children from the very beginning, since they were old enough to hear us say that we don't live in the projects anymore. We've transformed that. Our life is good. Dallas has been so good to us. Now they have a responsibility. When living with us, they didn't have a choice. But they were going to go out and they were going to work for people less fortunate than them. Fortunate for us. It became a part of their who they are. And now, as independent adult, one is still in school, but the other two are independent adults. Oftentimes, I have to bow out of circumstances of volunteerism. It's because they're already there, and I just don't want to be working the same side of the street with them. They're doing good work.
Other questions?
Albert, talk about your management of your workforce since 2002, and how did you come through that? Did you have to do layoffs? And how did you do that to where you could keep your Christian base with your commitment to growing people, but then make those tough decisions that have to be made?
I had to vicariously receive the curse through a set of women and men that made up a board. I didn't have the backbone or the courage to really do that. I'm not constructed that way. It wasn't until I was faced with the option that, Albert, you will make these kind of moves before our next board meeting, or you'll lose me as a director. The fear of that kind of change, of losing that kind of support, was so great that it overpowered my fear of keeping things the same. And so I made the decision. I'm still that flawed individual that would hesitate to do that. Now, we've become a lot better. We're not near as bad as slow. After what seemingly was a recovery around between October of 2003, and it lasted all the way up to maybe 2008, we thought that we were in a pretty good recovery, and I'm talking about as a country. And then we began to slip again. We made some decisions then because we had empowered other people to do it as professional managers that I think represent the kind of company that will sustain itself for another 28 years. I've taken it to a good place. They'll take it to a better one.
We have time for a couple more. Fred, I have a question. May I?
Sure.
In a culture where it's so hard to distinguish between for males, mm-hmm. That's I can speak about that, between our work life and who we are apart from that.
Right.
For example, my father always said that he never wanted to not work, and God rest his soul. The last day he stood was on the job. 3 weeks later, he was dead. So he never had to face this challenge of what comes after not being able to work. And you touched on that as a kind of spiritual growth. Could you say any more about, in our own culture, number one, is it our culture that this happens, or does it happen around the world? And number two, how do we deal with that in terms of both separating, getting our value from our work and who we are, and how do those fit together? You certainly touched on that.
Yeah. That's a good question, Todd. And I think it is a problem for men. Of course, it's becoming an increasing problem for women, too, as the work world has opened up appropriately. And so the challenges, I think, are as real for women and will continue to be as real for women as they are for men. And, in fact, I think to some extent even women of an earlier generation like my mother's, whose opportunities were almost all but non-existent for her, those questions still came with children growing old enough that they moved away from home. And so it revolves around a question of identity. And I think the first thing to realize is that it's genuinely an experience of grief. Because what our jobs and our work and our roles represent to us are not simply jobs, work, and roles, but they represent our sense of ourselves, our identity, our sense of control, our sense of being able to be in the world in one way or another. And so I think that the first step is to recognize the inherent possibility of the grief that's associated with it. The second is to work on the deeper vocational nature of the work that we do, to get to grasp those things that lie deeper than the jobs we do themselves. My father's not the only one I've grappled with over this. My brother, 4 years ago, was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor. And he's a hand surgeon. So one kind of nondescript Tuesday afternoon, he got the results of an MRI that brought the whole of his medical career to a halt. And he will never practice medicine again. And we've had extended conversations about how you grasp and hold on to and nurture your vocation as a healer, even if you can no longer function as a physician. And that's the kind of critical move, I think, that's involved. The other thing I think that's worth remembering is rather more a spiritual observation about life. All of the work that we do, I think, as important as it is in the moment, is but a vehicle for our journey into God. And if we can discover ways to kind of live into that journey, we'll discover that we will not be quite as attached to the vehicle as we are to the destination.
One more.
As an elder the same age as your dad, and as a grandmother and a great-grandmother, I have a wonderful function in my family. I'm of Italian origin, so in the face of fear, I say, coraggio, caro. Well, coraggio is take heart, dear one. So my sons who are in business, if they reach a place where they're not selling pianos or getting catering contracts, they call me. Figlio mio, coraggio. I'm also chairman of the board, president, and co-founder of Homeward Bound Incorporated. I'm sure Mr. Castle knows about us. And in the face of money not being as available through state and federal dollars, we have coraggio because we embark on new, just in the face of it, I said, we're so mean that we're going to get new contracts to do new things for people. So that's my function. I just love my new vocation. So, coraggio, caro. I'm so glad you brought up the fear. What are we afraid of? I mean, it just seems so sad. I see so many people just paralyzed by fear. So, I think just blast through it and do something more and exciting and in the face of all of that. So, thank you. And I just had to tell that I love being in my 80s. I turned 84 on Halloween, and that was a celebration. Thank you.
Fred, Albert, thank you both again.
Thank you.
We appreciate it very much. I have to admit, I'm a person of little faith. Every time we do this, I think, oh, it cannot get any better. What am I going to tell all these people next time they come? And you have proven that it only takes a mustard seed. All I have to do is show up because you guys, once again, have knocked it over the fence, if you'll let me use that metaphor. Thank you both so much.